This is Bottom Line. I'm Doug Wells, and today we're speaking with strategy expert and University of Utah professor Todd Zenger. Todd has a cutting-edge view on strategy. Most CEOs would say that strategy is positional. Find your unique product, create a competitive moat, and watch the profits roll in. Todd argues that this viewpoint, while accurate, is incomplete. To illustrate his point, let's briefly recount a story from one of Professor Zenger's publications. It is a story of Jeffrey Katzenberg, who in 1984 was hired by then-Disney CEO Michael Eisner. Back then, Disney had lost its way. Katzenberg was hired to get Disney Studios back on track, even though he had no experience with animation and he was not even a fan of cartoons. Fortunately, Katzenberg soon learned that the late Walt Disney had kept copious notes and scribblings from his days as a filmmaker and executive. Those notes were effectively a recipe for how to make animated films with the classic Disney flair we all know and love. Apparently, Walt's notes worked. Under Katzenberg's leadership, Disney went on to produce four blockbuster hits in just 5 years: The Little Mermaid, Beauty and the Beast, Aladdin, and The Lion King. Katzenberg had rediscovered the company's secret sauce, or to use today's guest word, he would say it's corporate theory. Today we're talking about the importance of having a good strategy and how companies and innovators can find and sustain winning strategies. Unlike Katzenberg, most of us will never find a hidden file with the secrets for running our business better. For us, perhaps the next best thing is Todd Zenger's recently published book, Beyond Competitive Advantage: How to Solve the Puzzle of Sustaining Growth While Creating Value. Todd, thank you for joining us on The Bottom Line.
Good to be with you.
So I was mentioning in the green room that I'm a fan of strategy. I love strategy. But let's start off with explaining to our audience what strategy is and why it's so important to companies.
So I think many companies, when you ask them what their strategy is, they have a vague sense of sort of, they can describe what they do, they can describe their goals, they can describe what they sort of aspire to be, but in truth, very often they have a difficult time describing the path that they're going to use to get to those goals. And I think strategy is very much about the clever path one composes to achieve a particular goal or aspiration that a company has.
Why do you think so few companies spend time defining a strategy and then executing on that strategy?
I think one of the challenges is that it's easier often not to choose. It's often we have lots of different goals, or we think that, look, here's a good way to achieve the goal, here's another good way to achieve the goal, and we sort of say, here's the goal, let's just sort of go at it. And often they're unwilling to sort of say, this is the path we're going to take, this is the way we're going to achieve that goal, and sort of say, and we're not going to do these three or four things. And often the essence of strategy is this ability to sort of say, this is not what we're going to do, more than it is saying, this is what we're going to do.
You know, it's interesting that you lead with that, because I think a great example of how strategy can make a huge impact on a company is Apple Computers. And Steve Jobs is famous for saying strategy is about saying no. Right. When Jobs took over Apple Computers the second time, they had really lost their way and they had a plethora of products. And Jobs came in and said, no, we're going to be the best in the world at five things, and defining what those five things are. But it's really hard to say no.
It is. It's much easier to sort of articulate in one's what they call strategy eight different objectives and pathways to success. And the problem is, and even you have clever companies that sort of put these into scorecards and metrics and sort of say, look, you should dial up and try to accomplish all of these. But the challenge is that provides no direction. Telling someone that they should go in eight different directions is not providing them with direction.
Yeah, and you know, all of these recipes, to use Katzenberg's situation, or what I call frameworks for how to think about your situation, They all have key pieces to it. I guess Porter's Five Forces is probably the most famous in strategy. You have your own framework. You call it corporate theory, and it has three primary elements to it. Let's first off, what is corporate theory?
So let me sort of just back up and set that up a little bit and sort of say that the way we typically thought about strategy is, as you articulated earlier, it's a position, and strategy is very much about figuring out what you want to do uniquely and carving out a unique place in an industry that others can't dislodge you from. But the difficulty is that the way we actually measure the performance of a corporation or the performance of a CEO is not whether they occupy a position, but rather their capacity to relentlessly create value. That is, if your stock price goes from 30 to 40, that doesn't mean a year from now when your stock is still sitting at 40 or 2 years from now when it's still sitting at 40 that you've been successful. It's really about your capacity to relentlessly create value.
And you use an example, Walmart. You know, Walmart's had a great strategy back in the day when they were building their strength as a retailer. To go into these small rural towns where there was only room for one player. There wasn't room for a second, and that gave them leverage to kind of build their systems. A lot of people don't think of Walmart as a technology company, but they really should.
Yeah.
They're one of the most technologically sophisticated companies in the United States. But yet people would probably be surprised to know that over the last 5 years, over the last decade, Walmart stock has really not kept up with the stock market. And I think you use it as an example when you talk about corporate theory. How is that a relevant example?
Yeah. So there are lots of companies we hold up as companies that have had great strategies, great positions, but just have not created value over the last, whatever the period of time. And a corporate theory is something that provides ongoing direction to a company, not in its path to a position, but rather in its path to composing value over time. So you talked about Disney. Disney not only did Katzenberg sort of find this recipe for producing animated films, but Eisner presumably found this remarkable chart that in some sense depicted a corporate theory for Disney that Walt had composed in the 40s and 50s that talked about animated characters being this fuel that would feed a variety of other entertainment assets, books, theme parks, hotels. All of this was sort of composed early on by Walt Disney, and it's been essentially a theory, a guide that has really helped subsequent CEOs see an ongoing succession of paths to value creation. So cruise ships, Broadway shows, further hotel, further theme parks have all sort of emanated from this theory that was composed in the 1940s.
It is pretty interesting. In one of your publications, I saw the chart that you're referring to, which Walt put forth in the 40s or 50s. And you can look at it and say, wow, that recipe, that strategy works as well today and is as relevant today as it was 60 years ago, which is kind of crazy when you think about it. So is it fair to say that corporate theory focuses more on actions, how you're going to do things in order to create value?
So I would characterize it as literally like an academic theory. But in this case, it's a corporate theory. It reveals your beliefs about how future actions will create value. So it's in some sense guiding strategic experiments that a company might take. So Disney says we're going to go buy a property on 42nd Street in New York, the seediest street at the time in New York, and we're going to start putting Broadway shows on that, in that location. That was a relatively crazy thing to most people who observed it at the time, and yet it was entirely consistent with this theory that they had composed. So it's very much forward-looking actions that a corporation can take, as opposed to a single destination, right? So a typical strategy we think of is it's a destination. This is a place we want to occupy. A corporate theory is something that provides ongoing vision to strategic actions.
Okay. And so let's talk about the pieces that are important to corporate theory. I mentioned there were three aspects to it. Let's take them one at a time. What's the first one you'd like to talk about?
So the first is there are sort of three sites, and the first site would be foresight. That is, you have a theory about, or you have hunches about how technology tastes are likely to evolve going forward, or you have two or three alternatives that might emerge, but you have a clear theory about what you think is likely to happen to technology tastes in your industry.
Okay, so the first one's foresight, which is kind of what the consumer is going to want in the future.
Yeah, or it could be what the consumer wants, or it could be what you think is going to happen to technology that might enable you to provide solutions to that customer.
Okay. And you mentioned there were three sites.
Second would be insight. That is sort of, this is a classic sort of inward look. What are the resources, capabilities that we currently possess? What is it that we do well? What's in our toolkit and arsenal that would allow us to provide value to customers? So it's sort of a standard inward look. What can we do? And the critical sort of metric there would be, what can we do that's unique? What can we do that's different than our competitors?
Okay. And so for the company owners that are listening to this and thinking, how do I put this into practice for my business? So let's say you're running a team of 8 or 9 people and you have a feel for where the market's going to go, which is the foresight. Then you look at your team and say, hey, what can we do that's unique? Corporations are interesting because I think of them as living, dynamic organizations. And as a CEO, you can look and say, what do we do that's unique? And you can also say, what should we be doing that's unique that we don't do today? And you could build that expertise over several years. How important is that aspect of it?
So certainly part of your foresight is being able to see capabilities are going to be valuable, needful in the future. And I think so that there is a complementarity there between foresight and insight. And insight's so particularly important because the only value you're really going to create is going to be that which you can do which is unique, right? If you're doing something that's common, if this radio show is like 1,000 others, it's really not adding value. Well,
maybe that explains why public radio works on such a shoestring budget and why it's important listeners support this station when we do pledge drives.
That's right.
Our strategy is that, we're trying to share information and I'm not an employee of the radio station, but it really is a public service.
Yeah.
But we digress. Let's keep going. So that's the insight. What can you do that's unique? And then your last site is cross-site. What's cross-site and why is that important?
So this is looking out at the array of opportunities that you have. It could be acquisitions that a company might have available for them to pursue. It could be new opportunities to pursue, new products to introduce that are consistent with one's insight, that is, are consistent with those unique capabilities and resources one has to deploy, and are consistent with one's insight. So we think that making these kinds of investments today, pursuing this kind of opportunity, is going to be particularly well positioned in the tomorrow we foresee, and we believe it's leveraging something that no one else can access. No one else can do this because of the unique resources, skills, capabilities that we as an organization possess.
And those all make a lot of sense. And essentially, this is a framework that you've put together. And I want you to talk about how you came up with the research, how you became confident that this is a framework that can be helpful.
What's the Malcolm Gladwell thing? You do it for 10,000 hours, and then it comes to you. I would say that the underlying research, writing, thought that has gone into this book is something that's accumulated for 20 years. Right? It was sort of 5 years after my PhD, I started teaching this part of strategy, which is sort of corporate strategy, kind of the where the focus on growth. And it was sort of developing my own thinking, doing my own writing, developing my own sort of ways of teaching it over that period of time that I think allowed this to emerge. I don't have any simple solution to that.
It's a big question. There's not a simple answer to it.
But I think your intuition about people want simple frameworks, and so there clearly was a push to compose this in a way that was accessible, and that's not easy.
If you're just joining us this morning, our guest is Todd Zanger. He is the professor of strategy and strategic leadership at the University of Utah. He's also the author of the book Beyond Competitive Advantage. You mentioned after getting your PhD, you started teaching students strategy. And one of the things in my research that I came across is when you're advising young business students, the type of first position to go to after business school, you counsel them to think more about companies that maybe are troubled and don't have it all figured out. Why? That sounds counterintuitive. Why is that?
I'll do a Disney case study with all kinds of students where the company's in turmoil in the mid 80s. It's being there's an attempt to sort of hostily acquire it and break it up, and we talk about sort of what happens after that point. And inevitably we'll have a discussion about the fact that, look, any of us could have taken Disney over at that time and probably created value. This was a company that was not being well run. There were a lot of enormously valuable assets. I don't know if we could have done, I tell them, I'm not sure we could have done what Michael Eisner did over the next 10 years, but this was laden with opportunity. And the reason to take over a troubled company is the benchmark. The game was about value creation, and someone who's been running it before you has been destroying value. And therefore, the opportunity for value creation, the upside is enormous. If you're taking over a company from a very successful CEO with a tremendous corporate theory that has engaged in a succession of strategic actions that have been enormously value creating, to keep that thing going is really challenging.
Yeah, and I'll talk about the other side of the coin. I agree with the opportunity that you just mentioned. I also think there's value for a young person in going to an organization that is well-run early so that you know what well-run looks like.
Yeah, my advice is to students, if they get a chance to be a CEO, and it's be CEO of a well-run company.
And that won't be right out of business school.
That's not going to be right out of business school.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
It's interesting. We keep coming back to Disney. You probably know this. The largest shareholder of Disney stock is the Steve Jobs estate now.
Yeah.
And Jobs is famous for having told Tim Cook, when Jobs knew that his time was short on Earth, saying, hey, don't make the mistake that Disney made. Because for years, Disney was caught in indecision, arguing amongst themselves after Walt Disney had died. The argument was, well, what would Walt do?
Yeah.
As opposed to what do the executives that have the information and their finger on the pulse and know their team, what does that informed group think that they should do? And so Jobs told Tim Cook when he was passing the baton on to Tim Cook, don't ever do that. Don't ask yourself, what would Steve Jobs do? Ask yourself, what would Tim Cook do, and do that. Is that story consistent with kind of the recipe that we were talking about earlier that was resurrected from Walt's vault?
So I completely agree with the advice. I think that one of the messages of the book is that the game of strategy is not about sophisticated analytics. It's really about careful theorizing. It's about carefully thinking about what it is that you believe that's unique and that you believe to be value creating, and then going and pursuing that. So that message is very consistent with Steve Jobs. Tim Cook, what is it that uniquely believe and you can convince other people of, that will be value creating. On the other hand, I think that in the case of Disney, I think what Michael Eisner does when he steps in and takes over for the successors that followed Walt was he basically did find this theory. He refound the theory that Walt had composed, and he creatively came up with strategic actions that were consistent with this theory that still had legs, still had value. Now, that's not going to, you know, that's a relatively unusual story, a company that's basically still following that same theory. Now, they've added Marvel and they've added Lucasfilms, and in some sense, it's gone beyond its princess-heavy character set that was sort of Walt's original set of animated films and what Eisner sort of continued with. But it's still really very, very consistent with that overall theory. But that's unusual. Most companies discover their corporate theories have run out of legs and they have to sort of recompose.
So that's a common occurrence, right? I mean, corporate theories work for a while and you have to constantly be looking at them. So if you're running a company and you had a strategy that was working really well for many years and now it's not working so well, what should those people do?
Well, I think that's the exercise of going through and saying what are, you know.
I'll put in a plug. First, you should buy Professor Zinger's book.
So then you should be thinking about what's your foresight? You know, what is your analysis of capabilities, resources, skills, your insight? What's unique about what you do? And then use those two lenses to sort of think about the opportunities that sit out there. What's the cross site? How does, through that lens, what opportunities can you uniquely add value to?
Great. You know, another area that you argue in some of your publications is that the capital markets, the stock market, let's just call it the stock market, fails to fully understand and value strong strategies. Hmm. Why do you feel that way, and why do you think the capital markets miss that?
So the most important word in strategy, whether we're talking about Michael Porter's version of positions or this discussion of corporate theory, the most important word is unique, right? If the strategy's not unique, it's not going to create value. If you're not creating unique products or you don't have unique assets that you're leveraging, you're not going to be creating value. But the challenge is that what's unique in the product markets is also unique in the capital markets. And convincing investors that this weird idea that you have, this weird path that you want to take, these weird strategic experiments that you want to run, or this weird corporate theory that you have about that's guiding them is going to be difficult to communicate, and it's going to be difficult to convince them of. And so there's always this uniqueness paradox. We talk about it in Silicon Valley is, you know, you've got some unicorn type idea. Those things are more difficult to convince venture capitalists to pursue. And the same dynamic plays out in public equity markets. The more odd the strategy is that you're trying to pursue, the more difficult it's going to be to convince investors that it's a good idea, because what's weird, you know, what's weird is weird to them too, right?
Although if they're good venture capitalists, that's exactly what they should be looking for. Let's take a short break, and then we'll continue the conversation with Todd Zenger, who is a professor of strategy at the University of Utah and also the author of the book Beyond Competitive Advantage.
You're listening to The Bottom Line on KCPW. For podcasts and more local shows and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org.
Welcome back to The Bottom Line on KCPW. I'm Doug Wells. Today we're speaking with Todd Zenger, professor of strategy at the University of Utah and author of the book Beyond Competitive Advantage, How to Solve the Puzzle of Sustaining Growth While Creating Value. So we were talking before break about weird and unique aspects and how that's important to creating value. I want to talk about a couple of examples. And as I was hearing you use these words, you know, a decade ago, I think those words would have been very descriptive of a company that's been wildly successful now, Tesla. Let's talk about Tesla and in your view as a strategy expert on what they were doing really well 15 years ago.
Yeah. Well, the story about Tesla still has to be written as to whether it's successful from a financial standpoint. But
they still lose money on every car they produce.
That's right. But what is true is that they've been very successful in telling their story. And now at this point, there certainly is no uniqueness discount. There's no weirdness discount that they're facing today. Now, if anything, there might be concern that there's sort of excessive confidence in what they're doing. But I think in this case, as much of the confidence I think from a strategic standpoint is in Elon Musk, right? And just the fact that people believe in his capacity to compose theories of value. And it may not be the car that he makes that ultimately validates the current market value of this company. In fact, it'd be hard to believe that it's going to be cars alone. But I think there's real confidence in his corporate theory. And in general, this is, I think, true.
Now, how would you describe Elon's corporate theory?
I don't know. I mean, I think there is real debate as to whether he has one.
So a good friend of mine was one of the first 10 employees at Tesla, yeah. Classmate of mine, and called me up and said, hey, I'm thinking of joining this guy, Elon Musk. And back then, Elon was not a household name. And he asked my advice. And making a car is so incredibly complicated. My undergrad's in engineering, and I shared with my friend, boy, it's a long shot.
Yeah.
Whether they're going to make it or not, because you got to get so many things right that are not unique and don't create a sustainable competitive advantage. You got to get all those things right in order to do the things that will allow you to create the sustainable advantage. So I really applauded the idea of an electric car. I wasn't sure that was a way to get the U.S. and the world off of fossil fuels. But boy, that guy just is relentless.
So it's clearly the case that, you know, there were all kinds of, I mean, no end of skeptics that the theory that he had about cars long ago was going to fail, right? And so I think part of the reason there's so much support is that he's proven us wrong, so many of us wrong to this point. And so there's a sense in which, look, he does have the capacity to sort of compose these theories of value and to execute on them. I'm not sure people are confident that the automobile is going to be the one that justifies the current share price and market value of this company. It could be batteries. It could be
the solar panels for our house that look like normal roofing tiles.
Yeah, I mean that this is a he's visionary and he is an evangelist. And that may be enough, right?
Yeah. You know, Elon has also brought back the power of the engineer, the power of intelligence. And it's a time that has come with some helpful tailwinds. I would argue machine learning and artificial intelligence also has given power to those folks. When I went to business school, the idea was somebody like Elon would start a company, and then there'd be a professional manager that would come in and take over and get the company to the next level. And 25, 30 years ago, that was very, very prevalent. We've gone full circle on that. Why do you think that is?
It's absolutely fascinating to watch sort of the evolution, for me, the evolution of the economy as shaped by Silicon Valley, that, you know, you're now in a place where you have, you know, whether it be Larry Page, Sergey Brin, you have these sort of folks that are firmly entrenched in these, in the leadership of these companies. They've set up governance regimes such that They have absolute full control. They're really isn't much shareholder, or there any need for sort of shareholder oversight in these corporations. And yet they, you know, unlike the stories of the 70s and 80s, these companies have been very successful in creating value, right? I mean, so you can't sort of point to and go, well, this is a failure. This is the shareholders need to rise up and revolt and discipline this sort of bad behavior. So it's been a real sea change, and investors have sort of bought into Elon Musk that he is going to be able to compose this value, and that's a very different.
Well, and Elon's fairly recent, but there's also the Steve Jobs example, the power of the founder, the Jeff Bezos, the Larry Ellison. I mean, the big companies do seem to have the original founder at the helm, and as a professor of strategy, does that change the way you look at frameworks, the fact that these frameworks are being executed at such a large scale by people that were trained on the technical side of things as opposed to the business side of things?
So if I'm not a finance professor, but if I was a finance professor, I'd look at this and go, this is the essence of bad governance, right? That these folks have so much latitude to decide on strategy. From a strategist perspective, we're sort of the counterpunch to finance and governance. We think the value lies in CEOs with great vision and theories about how to compose value. But both of those arguments are right.
And, you know, I guess if you get the unique product right,
it
delivering that unique product, the electric car, in a car that you're proud to drive, as opposed to, you know, electric cars used to be, you know, something the mainstream didn't want to own, right? They didn't have a lot of luxury to it. It was, you had to be a fanatic to want an electric car. And if the product is good enough, maybe just being able to get that out into the world, which is awfully hard to do, maybe for a period of time, that's enough.
Yeah.
And the key there is for a period of time. You know, the question using corporate theory is, what is Elon going to continue to do to get, which I think is why you're skeptical about the value, is he's not going to have the electric car market to himself for long.
Right. Now, it's interesting for me to reflect on Silicon Valley in that so much of the value of not just Tesla, but many other corporations, Uber, is all hypothetical. But I mean, it really is a theory that's been articulated by a founder, and people either buy into it or they don't, right? And if they buy into it, there are these enormous valuations. But they're all based on, it's not based on operating performance. It's not based on what the analysis of the financial analysis of these companies. It's really based on what people believe about the vision that these leaders have. In that sense, it's really very much about the corporate theories that they have. I mean, why is Uber valued at such a ridiculously high amount, or Snapchat? I mean, do we really know that? Does that have anything to do with the current financials coming out of these businesses? It doesn't. It's all about our foresight, you know, our insight to what extent we believe they have unique capabilities, and their cross-site, their ability to sort of link whatever they're currently doing, Tesla with the automobile or their battery farms or their technology, with the future opportunities that exist out there. And that's all about corporate theory. It's not about, you know, whether their ROE or ROI or their cash flows are higher or lower. It's pure belief on and about and criticism of their corporate theories.
You know, and one of the things about strategy is it helps you achieve your goals, right? And there's different ways to measure whether you've achieved your goal or not, which your question on valuation, I think, is a great point. There are companies that struggle for years and never really get recognized in the stock market, but they continue to do the right things, and eventually the market catches up to that. So from a strategy standpoint, how would you advise a business owner to think about, how do you know if you're successful or not?
Yeah, I mean, this is, so I write a lot about sort of strategic leadership generally, and you know, I think an effective strategic leader composes a theory of value, and then step two is you got to market it, and you have to sort of enroll the resources that you need to sort of pursue this. But ultimately, your barometer of success isn't necessarily what the current market value of your company is, even if you're private. I mean, there's some sort of market value for that entity, but ultimately, you know, value lies in your head, and either you prove everybody right or they prove you wrong. But you sort of relentlessly push ahead until you fail to be able to acquire the resources you need to pursue the vision that you have.
If you're just tuning in, our guest today is Todd Zenger. He's the professor of strategy at the University of Utah and author of the book Beyond Competitive Advantage. We've only got time for a couple more questions, and I want to turn the conversation more local. Well, we were mentioning unicorns earlier, yeah. And there's five unicorn, broadly speaking, five unicorn companies here. Pluralsight, I don't know if you're familiar with them, the whole teaching people how to computer program and learn coding. And, you know, they're interesting because a lot of their growth has come from acquisition.
Yeah.
Are you familiar with them? Or I'll give you the five. I'll give you the five, and then you tell me which one you'd like to talk about. So we've got Pluralsight. We've got Qualtrics, which does the online surveys.
Yeah.
They would argue that they're probably the most statistically robust online surveys that are out there. Let's see. We've got David Elkington's company, InsideSales.com. We've got Domo, Josh James, famously did Omniture before. And Ancestry.com would be another one. I'm thinking of one more. I'll get to it in a moment. But any of those companies you're familiar with?
So, you know, I think that one of the challenges, I'm familiar at some level with all of them, but I think one of the challenges that all companies face is sort of what's the next thing? You know, thinking about strategy not just as position and rather as an ongoing theory about the path to value creation. And, you know, for me, the example that everyone would be familiar with is GoPro and its, you know, camera, which was massively successful, fueled tremendous amounts of growth. They went public, but the thing ran out of gas, right? I mean, not only did that product plateau and begin to sort of fall off, but even if it had just plateaued and sort of, or even continued its current growth, the challenge was, what were you going to do next? And they have struggled with that. And, you know, they've tried drones, but the problem is it isn't something unique that's they're pursuing next. And you think about a company like Qualtrics has been enormously successful, and it does to me appear like they do have. That's a company that does have a sort of an overarching theory about where they're going to go. But, you know, that's the challenge for all these companies is, okay, you sort of have an initial product or service that you're pursuing, but do you really have a theory that's going to fuel your ongoing growth? I mean, what, you know, this is the same discussion about Tesla. It would be the same discussion about Apple. Apple's success was that it didn't just have the Macintosh. Eventually, Steve Jobs composes a broader theory that sort of fuels a succession of products. And, you know, that's the challenge that, you know, all these companies face going forward is not just can you occupy a particular place in a particular market, but, you know, what's next and what's next and what's next. And a company that composes a corporate theory, these are the true unicorns, right, that explode because people sort of see, okay, yeah, this is a company that's got a platform. This is Google, and they're going to be able to leverage that platform into, you know, endless array of products.
What's next, right? Yeah. That's the question that keeps every good CEO up at night. But Google's a great example, right, because they started with a search engine. Who would have ever guessed that a search engine would lead to the company that has the most autonomous driven miles.
Yeah.
They just announced last week 3 million miles driven autonomously on U.S. public roads.
Right.
Took 2 years to get to the first million.
Yeah.
Took about 6 months to get to the second million. Took about 6 weeks to get to the third million.
Interesting. I mean, Google, I think, I'm not sure. I think you could critique Google for actually not having a clear corporate theory. In other words, I think obviously their search engine and the advertising revenue has been enormously profitable. But I bet if you did a post-audit of many of their other investments, not so great.
And, you know, they're getting more financially sophisticated, which is why they started Alphabet Group, and they break that out for
yep.
people like myself that look at that professionally so we can get a better picture of, you know, what are these experimental projects? What are they really costing the company? But I do applaud them for giving smart people a lot of latitude
yeah.
to say, all right, go out there and discover what you want right. to discover.
I mean, if they had a corporate theory, it would be, let's take revenues from this hugely profitable business and give it to really smart people, and let's create an HR system that hires and keeps great people. And you know, is that enough to be a theory? I don't know.
The world will find out over the next decade.
But it's been successful to date in terms of funding a lot of new stuff, which is wonderful to see.
Well, I want to leave it on that note. I love the question, what's next? I think all of us as business owners, as students of business, we should always be thinking of that. Todd, thank you for joining us today on The Bottom Line.
Great to be with you.
Our guest this morning has been Todd Zenger. He is the author of Beyond Competitive Advantage, How to Solve the Puzzle of Sustaining Growth While Creating Value. He's also the chair of the Department of Entrepreneurship and Strategy at the University of Utah. Today's show was recorded at the KCPW studios on Library Square and produced by Ross Chambliss. Thank you, Ross. You can hear our entire interview with Todd on our website, kcpw.org, or on the Bottom Line podcast. I'm Doug Wells. Join us next week on The Bottom Line.